It's unfortunate that they have expelled us, but I respect their decision, and we're just going to continue to do what we do and focus on Joe Miller.
The Tea Party Express launches its effort to elect Joe Miller. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 19th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Nikolsky is unfazed by the big weekend earthquake.
What's amazing to me is that a nearly magnitude 7 earthquake in Nikolsky compared to, say, a magnitude 7 in Haiti, what the difference is and how it affects a community.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by Northrim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. Northrim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC.
Top officials with the Tea Party Express were in Anchorage today to begin campaigning for U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller. Miller is trying to win the Republican primary on August 24th against incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski. Brian Schroyer is a political director for the group.
This is our singular focus between now and August 24th. You're going to see several hundred thousands of dollars spent in this race, in television, in radio, in get out the vote efforts, and anything we can do to make sure that we get Joe Miller elected.
The Tea Party Express was expelled from the National Tea Party Federation this weekend after one of its founders made racist comments on his blog. Mark Williams wrote a satirical letter that was supposed to be from the NAACP to Abraham Lincoln that read in part, "We coloreds have taken a vote and decided that we don't cotton to that whole emancipation thing." Today, Tea Party Express Chairman Amy Kramer said Williams won't lose his job as party spokesman.
While Mark Williams may speak on behalf of us in some circumstances and some situations, and we may agree on some things, this is not one of the things that we agree upon, and Mark Williams is speaking on his own behalf and his own behalf only.
And Kramer wasn't concerned about being forced out of the National Tea Party Federation.
We're not here to be any member of a group or a good old boys club. We're here to work on a campaign and to get a conservative elected, and that's what we're going to focus on. It's unfortunate that they have expelled us, but I respect their decision, and we're just going to continue to do what we do and focus on Joe Miller.
The Tea Party Express won't say exactly how much money they will spend to elect Joe Miller or how many paid staff and volunteers they intend to have on the ground in Alaska. Steve Wachowski is communications director for U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski. He says he was shocked and disappointed by the Mark Williams racist comments, and he says the Tea Party Express only intends to smear Senator Murkowski.
We want this campaign to be about Alaska. Tea Party Express is a California-based fringe movement of the Tea Party. They've been expelled by the National Tea Party, and they've been distorting Senator Murkowski's record.
The Tea Party Express says its Joe Miller ads will begin airing next week. The Tea Party Express has had success in other Republican primary battles. In Nevada, it helped Senate candidate Sharon Angle defeat a better-known Republican, pouring $500,000 into her campaign. Despite an improving job market, thousands of Alaskans remain out of work, and some have fallen through the cracks as Congress argues over extending unemployment benefits. But that could change this week, and as KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, the state is prepared.
More than 700 Alaskans have exhausted their benefits since the U.S. Senate failed to extend federal unemployment payments at the end of May. Bill Kramer is chief of unemployment insurance at the State Labor Department, which is tracking how many people file claims after their regular benefits expire. About 2 weeks ago, the number was 734, and Kramer says it's safe to say it's gone up since then.
If Congress makes further benefits available, then we will process those claims and do what we can to get people paid.
Individuals who are out of work through no fault of their own are eligible for up to 26 weeks of regular state benefits. Until recently, they could also receive up to 73 weeks of federal extensions for a total of 99 weeks. When Congress failed to fund those extensions, people could finish their current benefits but couldn't move on to another extension. Besides the 700-plus people who tried to file additional claims, Kramer says he's not sure how many people didn't file once they heard the benefits had expired.
It's hard to know if more people would have filed or not. It's just, you know, impossible to predict.
Relief could be coming soon. The Senate is expected to vote Tuesday on a bill extending benefits. The House passed an extension July 1st, but Senate Democrats keep falling one vote short of the 60 necessary to break a Republican filibuster. That should change with the swearing-in of Democrat Cart Goodwin, who was appointed Friday to the seat held by the late West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd. In the meantime, Kramer says the department has been directing people to Alaska job centers in hopes of finding them work.
Generally, they're fairly busy. Summertime's the highest time for employment in the state, and they're trying to get people to work this time of year especially.
Alaska's unemployment rate dipped to 7.9% in June, down from 8.2% in May. The national average last month was 9.5%. It marks the 20th consecutive month Alaska's unemployment rate has been below the national average. State economist Neil Fried says that's a first.
There's not been another year where our rate has been below the national rate. So one thing I think you can draw from this is our labor market, our job market, although it's more competitive now than it was a year ago or two or a year and a half ago, it's still significantly better than the national average.
Not surprisingly, Fried says the biggest employment gains in June were in seasonal jobs like construction, seafood, and tourism. But other industries like oil and gas, healthcare, and government held steady. He says that's been the trend throughout the national recession.
We lost far fewer jobs. It's been much more mild for us, and there's even indications that our employment may be growing again.
Some economists say extending unemployment benefits will help the country continue to pull out of the recession. Workers and employers pay into the Alaska Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Kramer says it's among the top 10 highest performing funds in the nation. It currently holds more than $275 million. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The state today offered a little more time for a Texas-based developer to drill for natural gas in Cook Inlet, but not much. Technically in default, Escapeda Oil and Gas has one last chance to drill a well. In a letter to the company, the Department of Natural Resources placed the Kitchen Lights unit of Cook Inlet in default of its leases of more than 80,000 acres. Oil and Gas Director Kevin Banks says the leases have been extended four times and the unit is in line to be terminated.
You know, under the circumstances, with the passage of Senate Bill 309, I believe it was, that granted potential credits to drillers in the Cook Inlet if they, you know, bring up a rig and start drilling. And also, in an effort to provide Escapeda with the full due process that he should have, I think defaulting this time is certainly appropriate.
Development has stalled since geological and seismic tests done by Escapeda in 2001 and since updated indicated that the company has the potential to develop more than a trillion cubic feet of gas in Kitchen Lights. The most recent delay has been attributed to the company's need to rent a semi-submersible vessel and a jackup rig for the drilling operations. Banks says termination of the unit can be avoided if Escapeda meets a time schedule to resolve those problems.
However, in defaulting the unit, we've offered a cure, and the cure for the default is that Escapeda provide the state with a $4 million bond or financial instrument of some sort to assure that he has the rig under contract and underway in time for being able to drill the well next year.
Besides the $4 million bond, the extension of the lease depends on a well completed by the end of September 2011. Banks says the prospect is among the more attractive areas for development in Cook Inlet. The letter of default from Commissioner Tom Irwin says the state has seen strong interest in Cook Inlet development, and it is in the state's best interest to maximize the potential for the area. Danny Davis, president of Escapeda, did not return calls to comment on the company's plans. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, First Alaskans Institute starts addressing a subject they want Alaskans to think more about.
one of the first things that has to happen is that we actually have to start talking about racism in Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
A 6.7 magnitude earthquake struck in the Fox Islands region of the Aleutians on Saturday night. The earthquake hit about 40 miles from Nikolsky and was felt as far away as Kodiak. According to the Alaska Earthquake Information Center, the initial earthquake happened 21 miles below the seabed, and at least 20 aftershocks with magnitudes higher than 4 have hit since Saturday night. The strongest of these was a 5.8 magnitude aftershock that was felt in Nikolsky around noon on Sunday. Natasha Rupert, a seismologist with the center, says that the aftershocks aren't over yet.
We expect the aftershock activity will continue at least for a couple of weeks and maybe up to a couple of months.
For a 6.7 magnitude earthquake, the effect has been negligible. No tsunami hit in the aftermath, and no injuries related to the earthquake have been reported. While phones are down in Nikolsky, there also hasn't been word of any permanent damage, according to Cindy Preller at the Alaska Tsunami Warning Center.
From what we heard from a few folks that have called us from Nikolsky is that they felt some shaking, stuff fell off the walls and shelves, but no one was hurt. There were no injuries, and there was no interesting, odd, or significant water behavior. But what's amazing to me is that a nearly magnitude 7 earthquake in Nikolsky compared to, say, a magnitude 7 in Haiti, what the difference is and how it affects a community.
If the earthquake didn't cause much harm to Nikolsky, it caused even less to Unalaska, where about a dozen people reported feeling the earthquake to local police. Jamie Sunderland is director of public safety.
I would imagine most people didn't even feel the earthquake. I noticed it the one Saturday evening, little rolling in the ground there. But I would think if people were out active, they wouldn't have even noticed it.
The last time a major earthquake hit the region was October, when a 6.5 magnitude struck about 75 miles away from Nikolsky. Plans to develop an iron mine on eastern Prince of Wales Island are waiting for environmental issues to be resolved. The project is being watched closely by regulators, a nearby village, and an environmental group. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Poor Man's Mine project would tap a surface deposit of iron ore, also called magnetite, from a site near Kasan. Eagle Industrial Minerals of Mill Valley, California, wants to develop the small open-pit project about 30 miles northwest of Ketchikan. Developer Chuck Eaton says he's conducting an environmental evaluation to see if the project should proceed. He says he should have a better idea in 6 months to a year. Eaton wouldn't speak on tape. Jack DeMarkey of the State Department of Natural Resources is watching the project. If it's developed, he says it would blast the ore out of the ground and collect iron using a magnetic separator.
There's no chemical treatment, there's no heating process, there's no fine grinding. Even the tailings is a relatively coarse material, part of which would be placed back in the pit enclosure, and I think some of it would probably wind up being permanently stored on the surface there with some sort of a soil cover on top of it.
The company's website says the deposit includes approximately 3 million tons of good quality magnetite. It says there are also small but recoverable amounts of copper and gold. DeMarkey says the mine, if it proceeds, might be active for about 3 years. The proposal has raised concerns in Kasan, a community of about 60 residents, because it's less than a mile away. Nellie Nelson works for the Organized Village of Kasan, the Haida tribal government.
You know, it's just so close to the town, and they say there's going to be no disturbance, but I just don't see how that's possible. And, you know, they do blasting for rock and stuff like that, and they can hear that, and that's further away than what the mine is going to be.
He says it would also disrupt plans for an ecotourism lodge the tribe wants to build. Nelson says the tribe is also concerned that a salmon stream would have to be moved. DeMarkey says the state is also looking at that issue.
Our approach is basically no loss of fish habitat, and you know, that is an important issue for us. So he would have to come up with an acceptable design that would, you know, mitigate the loss of fish habitat long term.
Another concern is acid runoff created when water reacts with a mine's exposed rock. Guy Archibald follows mining issues for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
The main way of dealing with acid mine drainage in an open pit is just to flood it with water. That keeps the oxygen away from the rock so it doesn't oxidize, create sulfuric acid, which dissolves metals and heavy metals into the water table.
He says that would be difficult for the poor man's mine because it's on a steep slope. Eaton, the developer, says he's heard the various concerns and is considering them as he decides whether to proceed. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport is about 5 times bigger than those in other communities of the same size, in part because 90% of the cargo flights between Asia and North America come through Alaska. Cargo traffic has grown over the years, but recently dropped. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Billions of tons of cargo move through Anchorage and Fairbanks, making Alaska number 2 in the country and number 5 in the world for cargo traffic. As a result, the airport is responsible for 1 in 8 jobs in Anchorage and contributes $850 million in salaries to the economy, according to a study by the Institute of Social and Economic Research. And each landing brings about $2,000 in fees to the airport. But airport manager John Parrott says the number of landings has dipped.
We are landing in the neighborhood of 600 wide-bodied aircraft per week at the airport. And at its worst, we believe it was about 25 airplanes per week that were overflying us.
Parrott says part of the problem was the global recession, but another reason is a fuel shortage. Carriers can carry less fuel and more cargo if they refuel in Alaska en route. When fuel is unavailable or unaffordable in Alaska, some travel on to Canadian airports or to Seattle to refuel.
It's not a problem that causes us to wring our hands all day long, but it is a problem that we don't want to get to that point, and we want to resolve it while it's still small.
Demand for jet fuel is seasonal and can be unpredictable. Passenger traffic and merchants stocking up for Christmas keep planes and the refineries busy in the summer and fall. There's a big drop in cargo traffic in January and February when shopping goes down and when many Chinese take vacations for the Chinese New Year. Better forecasts of air carrier needs will help suppliers meet demand. That's one solution that has come out of discussions among a large group of stakeholders, including fuel providers and transporters, air carriers, and state agencies. The group has started talking about how they can better plan, communicate, and coordinate activities so that every carrier that wants to come through Anchorage can get the fuel it needs. I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Wasilla's Maurice Mo Bailey was laid to rest today with full military honors at Fort Richardson National Cemetery. Bailey, who died of leukemia last week at age 71, was the force behind Veterans Aviation Outreach, a volunteer organization that assisted Alaska's military veterans with everything from free air transportation for medical care to moose meat giveaways. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer spoke with Bailey a couple of years ago as he was organizing a veterans aid flight to Southwest Alaska. Here is the archived version of that story.
Maurice Bailey is a pilot and an airplane mechanic. He's at Wasilla Airport on a clear August afternoon working on a derelict plane.
Shape and ready to go to work.
as an outreach plane. It was a beater.
Bailey is the force behind Veterans Aviation Outreach, a nonprofit he started about 3 years ago.
Outreach is to find veterans in Bush, Alaska, which we have probably at least 30,000 or better, to find them. Most of them are unaware of their benefits, and a lot of them are old, and they do need to earn benefits.
Bailey says many Alaska veterans, especially those that live in the bush, are underserved, and he decided to do something about it.
I ran into a couple of other guys that I was in Vietnam with 39 years ago, and they threw in with me, and we formed the Veterans Aviation Outreach.
Bailey uses his own plane to help veterans. Bailey's Piper Apache is a far cry from the one he's working on. The Piper gleams red, white, and blue in the midday sun. It's in perfect shape.
This is a very, very roomy airplane. That's some cargo. I take the seats out. If you look back in the window, you can see how much rooms are really in there.
And how many passengers?
It actually has six seats, but I usually only haul two people. With these seats removed, it's got way more room.
Bailey says most of the outreach's work is aimed at locating lost veterans and bringing them into what he calls the system. Bailey says he did several tours of duty in Vietnam, and now he's still flying for his buddies.
They are veterans, and we keep saying, leave no veteran behind. We've left a lot of them behind. We need to pick them up. It's really easy to put a stick on your car to support the troops. Well, they got some guys right here that need support right now. And they have been troops, and they've been good troops. They suited up and showed up. And now they're old, a lot of them are sick, and they need help.
With that, he turns back to his work, balancing a propeller on a friend's plane. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Maurice Bailey died last week of leukemia. He was 71. First Alaskans Institute is working on a new project to address racism in Alaska. The Institute has a two-year grant for $350,000 from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation to start a statewide conversation on the issue. Liz Medicine Crow is leading the new initiative. She says the dialogue about race will start among Alaska Natives and grow from there. She wants to start things off with a big question.
Whether we're ready to profoundly change the discussion around race in Alaska as the first people of this land. And if we are interested in doing that, how do we do it? What are we willing to do? What are we willing to push for? What are we willing to let go of? How do we get there? That discussion will then kind of go out to another ring of discussions with people of color in Alaska, people who have moved here, who are of color, who are making their homes here in Alaska, asking them the same kinds of questions, and then broadening it out to the community at large, so that all the voices and the people in Alaska have an opportunity to really engage in the idea of a racism-free Alaska.
When you say profoundly changing the conversation, what do you mean by that? What do you envision that will take?
I think by profoundly changing it, one of the first things that has to happen is that we actually have to start talking about racism in Alaska. I don't think that we have acknowledged the role that it plays in our institutions, in our systems, in the way that we deal with each other on a daily basis. So having the conversation is really important. Naming it, calling it racism, understanding what racism is and how it impacts us, not only in our daily life, but also in our communities, in our state. And that's one of the biggest changes. For me as an Alaska Native person, I'm Tlingit Haida, I'm from Southeast. I don't think that we have actually tackled this issue as a state. And I look for a day in Alaska, in my homelands, where racism is gone so that we can actually achieve things in a much different way.
How do you think that you'll be able to both get people to have this conversation again, and what examples do you think that you can use to show them how racism exists? How do you see that being clarified, I guess?
The way that it's been envisioned through our project is really around developing opportunities for people to actually have conversations about the issue in a way that is not inflammatory, in a way that is not geared towards creating adversarial relationships between people and kind of fueling that race baiting that seems to happen when anybody starts talking about race and racism. So a really large part and component of the project is building relationships and partnerships with organizations that have representation from a really broad racial band within Alaska. So we'll have people from all different communities hopefully participating in the dialogue.
The project is 2 years, but of course we know that in 2 years you're barely going to get started with something that has taken generations to get to the point where we're at. How will it move forward, and how will you keep that momentum going?
There's a real interesting reason why we have this 2-year time period developed for the project. In 2 years, in 2012, the people of Alaska will be asked if they want to hold a constitutional convention. So over the course of the next 2 years, we're hoping to use that as a platform to really raise the level and engagement of the community around the issue of race and racism in Alaska. In looking at the state constitution, in the preamble, it recognizes and pays homage to the pioneers and those who came after. And wouldn't it be something if our guiding document in the state of Alaska acknowledged the indigenous people as well? And so looking towards how can we actually engage the community in a conversation about how we change our interactions with each other is really important.
Liz Medicine Crow is director of the Alaska Native Policy Center at First Alaskans Institute. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. You can also check out an audio slideshow of an Anchorage kite flying celebration in honor of ANWR's 50th anniversary at our website. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Jacqueline Estes and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Alaska's Institute of Technology Maritime Department is offering a Coast Guard-approved Marine Oiler class beginning September 13th in Seward. The course will familiarize students with propulsion, power generation, and auxiliary systems on motor and steam ships. Required prerequisite training criteria is on the web at avtec.edu. Information at 800-478-5389. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.